Have you given any thought to contributing to The Melt? It's easy to do. Just click the Patreon link in the episode notes, and for as little as $3 a month, you can get access to bonus episodes, early access to regular episodes, and you can also participate in monthly Zoom meetups. It helps to keep the magic happening here at The Melt. So I encourage you to karmically entangle yourself with The Melt today by subscribing monthly for less than the price of a container of goatee wax, or a prosthetic pinky, or a half stick of DMT butter, or an inflatable casket, or the shrunken head of an Atlantean supermodel, or a woolly mammoth's merkin, or a crystalline replica of Baba Yaga's hut, or a capsule of Sasquatch dander.
This is Hunter Muse.
And this is Chris Snipes. And you are listening
to The Melt.
So the other day I had to run some errands at a couple of different stores, and on the way to and between them I was listening to a podcast about synchronicities. I walk into the first store and I hear this. So, obviously, thinking nothing of it, I got what I came for and went about my merry way. It took me about 5 minutes to get to my next destination, and then when I get out and walk into the store, I hear this. The same stupid stick song during the same afternoon in which I was listening to a podcast about synchronicities. What significance that has, I do not know, but I took it as a playful elbowing from the great beyond, letting me know that it was in on the game. Another exercise in synchronicity involving music that many of you might have experienced personally is the experiment of listening to Pink Floyd's The Dark Side of the Moon whilst watching The Wizard of Oz. There are some seemingly undeniable syncs that happen, and it's hard to imagine that on some level it wasn't somehow orchestrated. Well, today's guest, David Charles Plait, has spent hundreds of hours syncing various albums to various films and has come up with some absolute doozies. Most of them are documented on the website thesyncbook.com, where they are available for streaming or downloading, including his 7.5-hour opus, Sorry Cassandra, I Misunderstood, Everything Predicts 9/11. Hunter starts off the conversation by asking David how all of this started.
It started with my brother showing me Dark Side of the Moon with The Wizard of Oz when I was in junior high. And I just became completely obsessed with the phenomenon. And I initially just went through Pink Floyd's whole catalog and was just like playing around with that. And, you know, one thing led to another. And I was like, well, what happens if I saw things that had correspondence? I think the first breakaway from Pink Floyd was when I was looking at Marilyn Manson's Antichrist Superstar. And then I was just like, Jesus Christ Superstar, what happens? And so that was really one of the only true viral videos that I accomplished, which was just on Vimeo, but it blew up, you know, to a degree. I'd tell it to people. I'd be like, oh yeah, you know this. And they're like, oh, I've heard of that. And I'm like, really? because I didn't tell you, so I guess things come back around, you know. But, you know, for the most part, I've struggled with platforms, and so I'm really grateful now that I have the syncbook.com. It's just a place where I can just point people to that. It just has all the work that I've ever uploaded, for the most part, is available there. I think there's like 200 films there. So,
maybe in case somebody out there is listening and they are not familiar with you and what it is that you do, maybe sum it up if you could, as far as your film work is concerned.
Yeah. Well, it's like, you know, light refracts water to produce a rainbow at 42 degrees. I like to treat the media, like the film and the audio, kind of like that. Like, it's like, everything will sync up to some degree. Every VJ definitely knows this. Like, you can just take things and you will make associations or whatever. I like it when like it crosses a certain line that is in the realm of something that you can't easily explain. And not just for the mind fuck of it, but just because it's a meditation. So like, I'll find different people's works that sometimes it'll be very meta, where it's like, delves into like real life stuff. Like when I paired Hollywood, Marilyn Manson's Hollywood, with the Holy Mountain, at that time when I was young, I didn't realize that Alejandro Jodorowsky had officiated Marilyn Manson's wedding, and that he made statements about that particular album and referred to it as Manson's magnum opus and all this kind of stuff. And so I speaking of syntax, it's like a lot of times it's how something was come to. That is really, on a personal level, what's unexplainable, you know, because, you know, I may not have come to something realizing the full backstory, and then it imbues the artwork even more, you know. And so I'll go by different things. I'll go by dates. If something was released the same day and year, and they seem to hold a certain resonance, I'll run experiments, and not all of the experiments are successful. It seems like over time I've had a higher success rate, and I think that's just because there's kind of a formula to it. And it's, you know, it's not the simplest formula, because it's, synchronicity is like irony. Like, you can't prove irony. Like, if you see something as ironic, I may look at it and go, oh yeah, totally. Like, I'll register it, but like, you can't, like, there's no, concrete thing. And I think that creates cognitive dissonance for people, because we like, you know, we got fact checkers, you know, do these things have a correspondence? Well, it's in the eye of the beholder. So like,
yeah, exactly.
You know, it's like, people could go to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and not be familiar with the ins and outs and the intricacies of everything that's being spoken to in like relatively contemporary Hollywood mythology, you know. And those people that aren't familiar with any of that, they're not even, a lot of them aren't even gonna know what they just watched. Like, exactly. They won't get the significance when Bruce Lee shows up and that he was right. The first person that Polanski suspected, because he was working with Sharon at the time. He's like, who would be capable of this? And it's like, he would never do that. But in Polanski, so it's like, but you wouldn't know, why is Bruce Lee being an asshole? You know, and it's like, because this is kind of a film for Polanski a little bit, because it can't be for Sharon. Right. She's not going to watch it. It is for Sharon. But you know what I mean? Like, and he got really nervous. He's like, what did you do with, you know, with he didn't hear about the movie until after it was done. And then he was like, and then Quentin Tarantino just assured him, he's like, you know, you got nothing to worry about, you know? And it's like, yeah, I mean, yeah. Anyway, it's that phenomenon.
Yeah, yeah. And synchronicity seems so subjective too, because different people are going to pick out different synchronicities depending on what speaks to them, what speaks to their own little mythology.
Right. It's very nerdy in a way, because it's like, if I'm looking at like the White Album and Rosemary's Baby or something, it's like, if you know the correspondences of the backstory of what's happening there, it's going to imbue the irony of a lot of the lyrical content. Because if you know what's like, that she got pregnant and she was, you know, while the film was being shot, and then she finds out and she doesn't know if it's Frank Sinatra's or Woody Allen's. It's just like absurd, but it's like, there'll be lyrical content that seems to be speaking to her conundrum. And it's like, does it just happen that way? I don't know. You know? I can entertain intentionality with several of them, you know, but I still can't pretend to know. I'm very comfortable in like gray areas, you know. I think I kind of trained myself to be that way a little bit. So whenever we talk about most topics, I'm not going to be very, I'm generally not very polarized. You know, I'm more comfortable personally in that space of like not needing to know everything, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. Totally.
Do you feel like this is something that other people are able to do? Is there a specific skill set that you have that really helps you to resonate or to be able to dial into these frequencies? Or do you think it's just kind of by happenstance that you kind of wake up to synchronicity?
Well, it's definitely like the aha moments, and I kind of live for those. So like, it's like when you make a connection and then you're like, what is there to that? You know, when you see what happens, like even like as I'm making them themselves, sometimes I'll raise the volume up between the vocals and certain ones call for it, certain ones don't. And there'll be just these happy accidents one after another, you know, and like, it's just in the experimentation things happen. So if I'm willing to entertain, it's like some, like there's like payoffs where it's like, oh, it's not just the first round. So it's like the round will happen and the second round will be even better. And had I not like just entertained it to that degree, I would have never witnessed that. And so it's kind of like, you know, like any DJ has to go and look through the crates to find the things that he wants to share. And then you get the luxury of not having to have gone through that yourself, if it's assuming he has a good ear, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, I have a friend who's kind of a purist, Bill Klaus, and I love him for it in his own way, but he's like almost opposed to like sharing them pre-made. Like he wants people to take that disc and take the components and run the experiment for themselves so that they have that experience. And like, I get that, but a lot of people in today's day and age, especially like you're saying, you're from another generation. Like I've met older people who shared Dark Side of the Moon, The Wizard of Oz in theaters. And I'm like, oh, you didn't have to deal with copyright or whatever. It's like, no one cared in those days. It was just because it was like it's like a collage. Like you can kind of like, you're like, oh, well, you know, and on platforms, video sharing platforms, they don't treat it as they're, you know, the scanners, they see so darkly. They can't see what you're actually sharing, or just like they can't register irony or sarcasm or anything in social media, you know, and that's unfortunate.
Yeah,
not everything absolutely. Is always that black and white, you know.
For sure.
Well, and there's definitely an art to it. I think that there's certain people that are drawn to this type of art because certain pieces really, really resonate with them. So it's like, I went through this period where I would listen to certain albums and then pair them with photographs, because that was something that really moved me, because I could see a photograph as being a moving object as opposed to it being a still. And I think that there's maybe a certain type of person that's drawn to this type of work. Do you feel like you attract other people that are maybe tuned into synchronicities?
I don't know if this helps answer your question, but what blows my mind is that, like, you know, I will speak very loudly. I'll try and get whatever platform I can at different points in my life to try and share my work. And as loud as I can be from where I stand, it still barely scrapes the, you know, the collective awareness of this kind of phenomenon. And so that lets me know, well, suppose, you know, there were secrets. I don't expect that we all know what those secrets are. And I don't think that all secrets necessarily have to be, you know, coming from a bad place just because they're secrets. And especially when it comes to art, like for me, like art by its nature, like what kind of constitutes art from my perception is like, is it subversive? But I would have to qualify what subversive means, because if you say subversive, are you talking about government, or what can you be subversive towards? So like a portrait of a person could be subversive, it depending on its effect. So if your portrait touches on something that somebody that doesn't see in themselves or something, and it brings something up and out, like that's a subversive act. Is it subversive to ego? Is it subversive to our conception of who we are? But it works the same way with like what is. So if you have a certain idea around what a piece of media is, I like to explore different ways of relating to the same piece. It kind of makes it more malleable in a way. And I think that there's like, oh, there's kind of a tradition there. Like I see, like Nietzsche spoke to that in The Birth of Tragedy from the Spirit of Music, where he's talking about like the Seder chorus, where you have something that's in between the audience and the production. and everyone's already familiar with the production because there's only so many Greek tragedies that they're watching. But then the Seder chorus would kind of like act as this maybe the subtext and the undercurrent thoughts and, you know, and it's also that they're kind of calling down different entities in the play itself. And like all of these kind of things are almost like you have to have the ego kind of step out of the way so that you can see what it is that's in front of you, you know, and see it in a more expanded light. And I think the idea of spectator, like us as spectators, like going to the theater is a very ritual act, you know, like, but, you know, it's like, in this case, it would be like the rituals are half revealed, half concealed. People took in a bit of media as spectator. It doesn't mean that the depth of the thing stops there. I'm also really, I really like Jake Coates's kind of definition of synchromysticism as it relates to the mundane. You know, so it's like media we generally relate to as a very mundane thing. I mean, I heard, I don't know how true this is, but I heard if you took the time in which people have spent watching Adam Sandler films, just Adam Sandler films on Netflix streaming, that all that time would stretch the whole of human history. So it's that's a very mundane activity watching Adam Sandler, you know, but it's like at the same time, it's like, you know, does that mean that there's, I don't know, like you can look at something that's superficial and it's almost like waves, the top of waves of the sea, and there's like something else going on there. And also that people compromise their art for the sake of industry, like for the sake of,
exactly,
you know, and what an artist may be doing in the midst of that, I think is really significant. It's like that idea of, I think it's Joseph Atwell, I don't think he was the first to say it, but this idea that the gospel may have been written by Josephus Flavius in a compromised position where he was basically, you know, you had like, they needed to recreate some version of the Torah. And so he was potentially there working for the Romans, but at the same time, he's not gonna give he's going to give them what they're looking for, but in the midst of that, he's going to be subversive. So it's like you have like an artist like Lady Gaga or something. You're like, look, she's a product, but she's kind of like a product as in like Metropolis, that the you know, that the Gollum type robot, that she's there to control the workers, wink wink, you know what I mean? Like there's right. something else going on, and this isn't all there is to her, you know. There is this other self. And I think that's why maybe like a lot of musicians have these alternate personas and they're like, that's not really me. So it affords them this outlet. Like even David Bowie would go through multiple different like archetype periods, and you have concept albums are attached to those. And so you play these different characters, like even Eminem with Slim Shady or something, you know, Andy Kaufman with his, what was that guy's name? I can't remember. I'm thinking Clifton was...
Tony Clifton.
Tony Clifton.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, yeah. So anyway, I don't know. I think that there's something to be. Am I answering your questions?
Yeah, of course.
You ask me something, and then I go on a tangent. But yeah, I mean, it's relevant. I feel like it's flowing. Yeah.
Questions are just stakes in the ground, and exactly. Where you wander from there is yeah. Right. I mean, it's all connected. It all goes back to the stake.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the Seder chorus can also be the catalyst. I think that's the thing that kind of wakes you up from the inane and the kind of rote nature of going to a theater, is that you have this other thing that is introduced in there to kind of really bring you into the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's something that's fluid in the midst of something that's in a sense concrete, like Apollo, like Apollonian, you know, structure is like you have statues and you have something that's very physical, and the Dionysian throng, the followers of Dionysus, have a very free, expressive way about going about things. So it's kind of like, that's why supposedly like Apollo as the destroyer is like, order is all well and good, order is not a problem, but if you take order too far, it becomes destructive to a society. So
absolutely,
you know, you need that some degree of balance there.
Well, you mentioned a formula about doing what you do, and I would like to get into that eventually, but I'm interested also about the process. Like when you're thinking about, I mean, first of all, do you start with the film or do you start with the album? And then are those, both of those, drawn from your lexicon of known films and albums? Or do you just get pulled to something that you may not be that familiar with and say, let's try it?
I mean, I'll often get introduced to music and films that I would never otherwise watch. Just by, I'll be looking at like a release date example, be like, if something came out the same day and year, I'm like, well, I have to explore that. And I might know one component and I don't know the other. And if I see some meaning that's a relationship that raises an eyebrow, then I'll be like, okay, I need to check that out. You know?
And does that, I mean, do the, I know that there's no black and white answer to this, but is that, do things that have sort of concurrent release dates, do you find that they have more overlaps than, say, something like the Jodorowsky movie and the Marilyn Manson album that were released at completely different times?
Oh, yeah. Well, sometimes if something's released at the same time, I've noticed that the synchronization sometimes can be a little over the, like, even more over the top, that can happen. Uh-huh. You have things that came out the same year. I mean, like, would you like, and I can go on a crazy tangent if you want, and I've shared certain
Please
things
do.
On other programs, but you're always going to have new people listening or whatever, so.
Yeah. Do it.
Like, Hal Craig. Have you ever heard me talk about Hal Craig on
No.
Grammarica or anything like that? So, Hal Craig, let's do a walk through this. So, I originally became really interested in Napoleon from Kubrick's conception of Napoleon. And I went to the Kubrick archives at Elephant Castle in London, and I went through every box they had on Kubrick's Napoleon just to see, you know, all the letters of exchanges. I was really interested in him, why he left that project, because I'd heard budget stuff. None of that seems to check out. The budget of what actually ended up being produced as Waterloo, I believe it was about 3 months after Kubrick dropped the project, production started for a Rod Steiger film, Waterloo, Dino De Laurentiis production. And, you know, I think it was a letter from Audrey Hepburn in her response to him wanting her to play Josephine, where she said, you know, are you aware of the Rod Steiger film? And I can't find a return letter of him ever acknowledging it. But I basically just, I went through this whole rabbit hole with that. And then I found that something incredible happens when you play Waterloo, the Dino De Laurentiis film, with ABBA's album Waterloo. And it's like,
wow.
And I realized
wow.
that like ABBA's album Waterloo is basically a concept album, but kind of in a meta sense, because like you have the song, What About Livingston, on there about, you know, discovering the source of the Nile, you know, and everything that went in. So she's like, in the song, I don't know if you know it, but she walks up to a newspaper stand and there's these old guys talking there about we're going to the moon, you know, and they're like, what's the point of it anyway? And then she's like, basically, well, what about Livingston, like all the sacrifice and everything that went into that? But it seems to be like, are you talking about colonizing the moon? And then it's like, because what is the justification for why we should go to the moon? And then you bring up this guy about colonizing, and it's like, this doesn't make sense. But it's in the album, and it speaks to like the advertising campaign for 2001 A Space Odyssey. I've heard from people that the original credits for 2001 used to be much longer, and that it included all this military staff, because originally NASA was a military organization. And some of those people, for consulting or whatever it is that they were doing, they were originally like in the old reels. They're like supposedly included in the credits. Whatever the case, like that's there. So it's like, it feels like this kind of Kubrick reference in the midst of this thing, Waterloo relating to Napoleon or whatever, but it just blew my mind. And I went from there looking at like the writer of this film, Hal Craig, and I was like, because capital H dot capital A dot capital L dot, so if you type it in, you're going to find Hal 9000, Hal Craig, whatever.
Right.
And I was just like, oh, that's interesting. And I went on, I think it was Grammarica, and I talked about this whole thing about Hal Craig. And it was within, I believe, a week of that, less than that, that all the Wikipedia for Hal Craig disappeared. So he had his own page and it was just like gone. And I was like, what is that about? And you can still find it in German, but not in English. And it was like, it was the time that just blew my mind. And then I was researching this guy and I found out that there was a siege in Washington on March 9th, 1977, that lasted 3 days over the release of a Hal Craig film called Muhammad, Messenger of God. And that basically like they it was the day that they chose was because that was the release date of this film. And so I think it's like 100 something hostages were taken in Washington, and, you know, Islamic terrorists or whatever. And this film seemed like, the way that they advertised for it, it seemed to suggest that it was like, you're going to be looking at a film with Muhammad, and everybody knows you're not supposed to do that, and you're going to upset some people if you try it. You know, this is not news. And so this man, Hal Craig, he'd written a book on the birth of Islam. I believe it's the only book that he's published. So he obviously has this interest, and he directed two different versions of the film. One is all in, people are speaking Arabic, and the other one they're speaking English, and they're almost the same film, but he just shot it twice, which is seems kind of unusual. So there's two Hal Craig films. There's The Message, released on the 9th, and then there's Airport 77, released on the 11th of March 1977. And that's, they bookend the siege. And so one is about the birth of Islam. The other one is about a plane hijacking by terrorists, respectively, the 9th and the 11th of 77. I went on, I think it was Grammarica, and I went off about this. And I didn't even know at the time that, so like, I got curious. I was like, did anything of significance happen on the 10th? Like, I'm totally open, anything. I found one event, and that was the biggest rock and roll concert being called off in rock and roll history over bomb threat. And it was ABBA in Australia. And ABBA was touring the album, ABBA the album, not to be confused with self-titled album, it's a different album. But it's called ABBA the album. And then so they had ABBA the movie also came out in 1977 of that tour. And so I'm like, so what are the chances that on the 10th, like the one thing that I happen to find while I'm on this trip, this is a syntax thing, because I'm looking at it because of Waterloo. And so, and the Hal Craig phenomenon. And I'm like, wow, what the hell? And so ABBA and Hal Craig with Waterloo. And then I'm looking at like this thing. I'm like, okay, so what happens if I play ABBA the album with the movie The Message? They changed the title to The Message because Muhammad, the messenger of God, apparently wasn't going over so great.
Right.
And imagine that.
Yeah. And so if you start ABBA the album the second that The Message starts, it'll make exactly four rounds and end the second that it ends. Same thing is true for ABBA's, I think it was the previous year, I think it was 76, they did Arrival. And Arrival pairs with King Kong in the exact same way, and I actually discovered those two back to back, where it does four complete rounds to be in the second that it fades in and the second that it ends at the end of the credits. So it's like, it's an exact fit. So if you're using an editing program and you loop it and you see what it looks like, it's just like a slot that it just fits into. It's ridiculous.
Well, for instance, one just very quick question. How in the hell did you pair King Kong and the ABBA album?
Arrival. What? Actually, when Arrival plays the first time is when they arrive at the album. And it's all, like, that sequence is like in of itself, just like a music video of like, you know, the arrival, you know. But yeah, there's the helicopter on it. But I actually sat in that helicopter in Sweden a couple of years back. It's kind of fun to go to the ABBA museum, you know. But yeah, I actually have ABBA tattooed on my arm, actually.
Oh, wow. Amazing. Cool. Amazing.
You have an ABBA connection, right? Somebody that you're related
to.
Yeah,
I have family in Sweden. And I was, before, you know, all of this hysteria, I was making it a point to visit my family in Sweden every year. I got my cousin there, really close. So, yeah.
So do you find sinks, physical sinks in your life, now that you've kind of delved into this world, like you'll have I had this experience where I was doing research on someone very specific, and I was looking for a very specific book. And Chris and I went to a garage sale, and this guy had a set of stuff that it was just out on the street. And he said, oh, you can take whatever you want out of there. And I reached down into the box and I pulled out the exact book that I had been looking for, mm-hmm. which was an insanely rare book that I found. Do things like that ever happen to you?
Yeah, of course. The thing is that if anyone ever shares a personal synchronicity with somebody, it's like a ghost story. Like, right. Yes, yeah. I believe you. And sure. This is your experience. I like the media stuff yeah. because it's like you can it's documented, you know, like, yeah, here, look, yeah. you can, if you don't believe me, check it out for yourself, right. you know, it's that, yes. that kind of thing. It's like, you know, probably get, my rabbi used to say, get all this from a leaf, you know, but at least with media, it affords you the ability to like have somebody else see it and go, oh, okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, if you look deeply at a leaf, you know, you can see it all, you know.
But, yeah, yeah, exactly. As hard science as synchronicity can get is kind of what the realm that you delve in.
Mm-hmm. I think that things happen on their own to a degree, and that a lot of what we call magic is actually just kind of directing that in accordance with the will. So like, sure. if you just even have the intention for something, it's amazing what that intention can accomplish, you know?
Yeah, I was re-listening to your interview on Gramerica one day. I was in one supermarket. I heard sticks, too much time on my hands. I had to go to another supermarket. What is playing but sticks, oh. too much time on my hands.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, did I talk about yeah. the 007, The Spy That Loved Me, which is also Kubrick had a part in the end of that film, in the cinematography and the lighting. They actually snuck him onto the set and he assisted. So yeah, I have a thing. So sticks, what album is that? It's the old movie. It's got Sail Away on it.
Grand Illusion.
The Grand Illusion. So the Grand Illusion yeah. was released on 7/7/1977, which was the same oh, wow. day and year that 007, The Spy That Loved Me came out. And so, and then they strange a track with Jaws. So there's Jaws is the character in the 007. And it's in this version, if you play them all three together, it's like Jaws survives at the end. Like it says, though the shark survived, because the last shot or the end of 007 is the character Jaws swimming away, you know?
Yeah.
So, that's just one thing. There's a bunch of ridiculous stuff that happened all the way through. Yeah. I like it too, with the idea of John Dee and his sigil board, and how I saw that in London actually a few years back. It's hard to find if you go to the museum because they got a million things in the place, but like you have to find like one little thing. It's like, and they don't tell you where anything is. So it just, I think it's smart. I think it's because they get you to look at all kinds of stuff that you wouldn't otherwise probably be exploring because you're just looking for something, but whatever.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And of course, this is February, the second month, 22nd of February, 2022.
Right. So, we're on one of yeah. those. Okay. There we go. Yes. Appropriate.
Yeah. So I'm just waiting for the synchronicities to pour in.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I want to mention one other thing before I get off
yeah,
this, because we're going to finish this phone call and Zoom call, and I'm going to be like, oh, what were the things that I forgot to mention? So I'm going to say it while it's in my mind. So I had speculated all kinds of weird stuff about this Hal Craig guy. I was like, is he an alias for Stanley Kubrick? Did Stanley Kubrick actually end up writing Waterloo? And I was researching Hal Craig, and I found his obituary from the New York Times. If you look at this, it says outright that he wrote Barry Lyndon. And I'm like, wow. Why does it say that Hal Craig wrote Barry Lyndon? It clearly, like, the screenplay is supposed to be written by Kubrick. And so I was like, so for me, it's like, I don't think the New York Times made that up. I think it was that somebody died and they gave him credit where credit was due for something that he wasn't given credit for. Not because, you know, if there was anything bad there necessarily. It's just like, I had gone off. This guy had like a twin brother named Dick and speeches for the Queen and all this weird stuff. And I was like, this is an outlandish character. And I couldn't find his picture anywhere. And so I was like, does this dude even exist? And then I ended up finding a documentary of the making of The Message. And I saw his face and I saw him speak. And I was like, okay, I know this guy's a real guy at least. And so, but Trumbo, are you guys familiar with Trumbo at all? So they made a film about it and they made a documentary about Trumbo, but he was blacklisted from Hollywood as a communist. And he was so prolific and he would write his scripts with other people. So it's not all just him, like they share scripts and they pass them around. They still do this all the time. I have a friend who he had an encounter, or his parents had an encounter with Carrie Fisher, who was working on a script for, I think it was Whoopi Goldberg, and just like showed up at the house. Just saying that, like, the way things that come to be, we look at a name on credits, it's not always exactly how it went. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
So, like, things are passed around, people tweak things here and there, you know, and it's not always who you'd expect. But, you know, Trumbo, he wrote Roman Holiday, which got an Oscar. that he accepted the Oscar without showing up. Somebody else, you know, it was basically they said, he's not here. He didn't have like an actor stand in. They just said he couldn't make it, but it was a made up name, you know, and the first director to actually include his actual name after all these years being blacklisted. It's an incredible amount of movies that he did. I think he actually got 2 Oscars, but was Stanley Kubrick for Spartacus. And so Trumbo was credited as writing Spartacus after no one would give him credit all that time. And so when I look at that, I'm like, is it possible? Because I was entertaining that Kubrick had some part in Waterloo, given that, you know, he dropped what he was working on. And I mean, it's a lot, you know, like the amount of work that was going into his Napoleon Josephine film. And so my takeaway is that this is wild, you know, speculation. So I'm not saying this with any ounce of authority, but all signs for me point to Occam's razor. That Kubrick contributed to Waterloo, and part of the indication of that is the subtext of the film, which is actually, from what I gather, and I've asked others about this, so I know I'm not just on my own trip or whatever, but it seems to be like a homoerotic love story between the Duke of Wellington and Napoleon, and basically speaking to like that these two guys wanted to show each other how big each other's dicks are, and using their arsenal to demonstrate that. And so somebody had sent Kubrick a letter shortly after the release of Dr. Strangelove, asking about the subtext that he was perceiving in Dr. Strangelove as the whole thing is basically a sexual metaphor. And Kubrick completely acknowledged it. It's one of those rare occasions where he's just like, yep, you nailed it. And he says from the beginning to the end, I think he says the last spasm, I believe was his actual words, probably referring to the fact that when it ends in nuclear war, that's like a symbolic orgasm. But it's like clefotic. It's like the Kleepo, because everything's in reverse, like the Kleepo mirror tetragrammaton. I don't know if you know what the hell I'm talking about, but like Kabbalistically, it's like you have the pleasure principle and the death instinct, to use psychoanalytic terminology, but you have this, you know, I pressed her thigh and death smiled kind of thing. And so the I don't know what he is, a colonel or what's the general Ripper, I believe. What I'm maybe mixing up my names, which is terrible if I present myself as a Kubrick fan or whatever, but the one who's worried about our precious bodily fluids and the communist plot. And he's like, you know, I don't deny women, but I do deny them my seed or whatever, you know, because he's not orgasming. And it's like, dude, the whole thing is about repression. It's like he's repressed and now he's going to sublimate his sexual frustration into, you know, he's going to need another outlet. So it's like this act of destruction is coming from his own sexual repression. And so like basically Russia and America become like this kind of like allegory for, or maybe I would say extension of all these people's, you know, neuroses. And so everyone
very
in the
Freudian
film everyone's neurotic. And you see Peter Sellers' character. Like, it wasn't even meant originally to be a comedy. It became a comedy pretty early on, because it was like Peter Sellers was just such a riot, you know? So they just went with it. But I think that same thing that's going on in Dr. Strangelove is actually happening in Waterloo. So I don't think he wrote it, but I think he influenced it. And I think he contributed to it. So that's where I speculate about Waterloo. And then I think that same thing happened in reverse with Barry Lyndon, where it's like, yes, Kubrick's working on this thing, but then Hal Craig is assisting him. So I think they worked together twice. And knowing like, there's examples, like I was just saying with 007, where it's like, this isn't always need to know basis for the public, and not all secrets are nefarious, you know, there's not necessarily anything wrong with that. But I think they kind of like that, you know, like, and also just making people go crackers, you know, like if anyone ever admitted, like if there was ever a musician or a director, whatever, somebody, an editor that ever wanted to say that this is what goes on and that there's secret screenings that people relate to their films in a different way or their music in a different way, like it would ruin it. It would totally ruin it, because it's in the cognitive dissonance of you not knowing. You're like, how does this happen like this? Where it's almost like miraculous sometimes. I mean, there's different examples through my work where it's just like, I cannot explain this, but it does this, it just does. And so it's possible that it's just the fucking universe. I don't know. You know, this is the way things are, you know, but I think it's both. It's kind of a Forrest Gump take. Yeah. I think both are happening at the same time, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think Hollywood thrives on subtext, and they thrive on this marketing. So if you use like Good Will Hunting as an example, seven writers worked on Good Will Hunting, and the final shooting script was William Goldman's. Mm. But to market Good Will Hunting, of course, we have to have these two young guns that have written the script, and it really seems like it's this, you know, overnight success story. But that's not really what happened.
Totally.
The reality is that a professional screenwriter wrote that script, and he did not get credited for that script.
Right.
So that's kind of what they get off on, is creating this mythos and then kind of running the marketing on that mythos.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. And it's like the idea that, you know, I was told I'm going to be kind of share something that at a certain time in my life I wouldn't have shared, but I'm not going to say all of it. It relates to Jack Nicholson, who was a friend of mine, but not just a friend, like a extended family relative. So when I was like 18 years old, my sister's husband's sister, she was in Hollywood, and she's in several films. She's in Hook. She was set to be in Bram Stoker's Dracula, and she didn't take the part because of nudity stuff. And she said that the casting agency wanted her to be one of the three vampiresses in bed with Keanu Reeves desperately. Mm-hmm. And she was like, why did they want me to be one of those vampires so badly? And she told me that it was because she had played one of the sirens in Hook, and that they wanted to strange attract the sirens with the vampires. And it's
interesting.
And that she told me, she's the first person ever to tell me about archetype casting. So you know about typecasting. She was like, no, they, even with the freaking, like, not people in the main, like not the main characters even, but just like people that show up. She said that Hollywood has this kind of mythology that's kind of this tapestry of the way that everything connects, and they like to play with it in particular ways. It's like having Willem Dafoe in Lars von Trier's Antichrist after he was in The Last Temptation of Christ. Like, it makes sense. Like, who would have cast in this? Well, that makes symbolic sense. And so she talked about that you'd have the party in Hollywood, and you have the party that's the real party. So like people are at the party and they're like, oh, we're having a great time at the party. And then she's like, then there's the real party. And this is, you know, and like, that's, I guess, a matter of perspective or whatever, of what you're after. But, you know, and, you know, I think that that's always been something for artists. I think that a lot of times, too, that if you want to produce something truly subversive, that if you want to get away with that, you can't put that all in the light. You have to kind of like encourage people to, like, you know, to look beyond. I mean, it's kind of a dichotomy, and it's kind of a catch-22. You know, it's like the Freemasons stating in Morals and Dogma that our stated goal is to illuminate humanity, you know, and then you're all about secrecy. But there was a time for like Kabbalists that it made total sense that you have to be kind of secretive, because you don't, you know, not everybody's going to get it, and it might require too much context to try and explain something on the spot. I mean, people now will want a sentence or a paragraph to explain a complex issue, and if you don't deliver, then they don't think that you understand or something. It's like, you know, you can't, you're like talking to a mechanic and you're like, here, explain how that engine works, and you're like, oh, well, hold on, let me get a step by step, you know. It's like,
but not everything's a fucking soundbite,
right? Not everything's a soundbite.
That's the reality, is that I think the people who know are the people who are able to kind of step back from something and maybe see it at 30,000 feet, as opposed to try to get myopically into something. Because sometimes there is an infrastructure that we can tap into if we're willing to do what you're doing, which is to look at the synchronicities, not necessarily look for them, but mm-hmm. look at them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't always know, like, it's such a loose term. So like, if you're talking about something that's intentional, is that a bona fide synchronicity, you know?
Right.
But if something's magic, some people relate that something happens magically, that means that we had no part in it. Whereas another person might say, oh, it's magic. Oh, it was directed that way. And so my sense is that those are kind of lines in the sand, like a lot of things are, and that we want to compartmentalize something that kind of goes beyond that, you know, or can go beyond that.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it's such an ink blot too. I mean, a synchronicity, as I said, and as you alluded to too, is in the eye of the beholder. So how powerful and how deep that synchronicity goes really depends on how you're looking at it.
Yes. Jung defines it as a meaningful coincidence. And if you say that there's coincidence, and then you say there's coincidence with meaning, but then who's supplying the meaning?
You exactly.
Know? And how does something translate from one person to another? I mean, I feel like that was kind of one of Terence McKenna's kind of fixations, is like this idea of like, is like communicating an idea in such a way that it's translatable, like beyond all languages, beyond all the particulars, like somebody can get a reception of something, you know.
Yes.
Kabbalah literally means to receive, you know, and that requires openness, you know, that's, you know.
Yeah. But I think too, even if you're talking about intentional synchronicities, sort of like if an album, say, that came out the same time that a film did or around the same time, and they were meant to go together, like sort of like putting two translucent pirate maps together, and those little squiggly lines on the bottom of them, when they're overlapped, they actually say something, is still, you know, perceiving that is still leaves some, there's still some subjective component to that.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, even if it is intentional, it doesn't mean that you're going to pick up on all the messages that are left there.
Right. If you start ex machina and under the skin at the exact same frame, exact same second, then the two films will cut to credits. A frame cuts to black. That frame aligns. So, like, they cut to credits at the exact same place that they started at the exact same place. Like, why is that? And like, for me experientially, it's like, I didn't experiment with those two movies, with any other movies. I saw the resonance between what they were communicating as like the replicant and the actual organism. So they sacrifice, I don't know if you've seen either of these movies, but with Under the Skin with Scarlett Johansson, she gets basically sacrificed at the end. She gets burned. And in Ex Machina, the replicant is free. And so it becomes this kind of like statement on like what our neurotic tendencies are, you know, as human beings. Like our general orientation is to destroy the thing that's the organism that's mysterious and prop up the thing in its place that we built. So it's the difference between making in the creative sense and building something. And, right. You know, and it's all fine to build, but when you put that on a pedestal above, at the, you know, I'm sitting here smoking, but and you know, it's like the organism itself is obviously the primary thing. This is at the heart of it. Like, you, why would you sacrifice this for the sake of that? It's completely backwards. But a lot of our goings on are completely backwards in the first place. So I think that's, you know, part of why a lot of our solutions are flawed and sometimes add to problems rather than solve them, you know.
Do you think that artists are going, or filmmakers are going, or even musicians are going into their craft with the intention of creating subjective or objective art?
Oh, wow. Yeah, I think that there's something to like an artist wanting to keep something for themselves in the midst of knowing that who they're working for is going to want to make it into something else. So it's like this kind of striving to hold something, you know, that you can still hold on to and call your own. And so that will often be something that appears very personal. Like, there's examples of things where I've felt that I've discovered something, but it felt like it wasn't for me. Like, this is for somebody particular, and it's not for me as, you know, whatever I am, you know, fanboy or whatever, you know. It's like, this is for somebody. I felt that with Sean Lennon, with if you take with The Haunting of Julia, which also had the working title of Full Circle. It's a movie with Keira DeLay and Mia Farrow, where their child chokes on a green apple at the beginning, and there's a failed tracheotomy from Mia Farrow. And there's symbolism in this movie that seems to tie together 2001 A Space Odyssey and Rosemary's Baby. Which incidentally are the same length if you start where Rosemary's Baby at the Dawn of Man fade in. Those both 1968 movies, they seem to be about two sides of the same thing, both having to do with childbirth. One, the birth of the Messiah, 2001, the Star Child, and the other one, the birth of the Antichrist, so to speak. And so they're this very poetic polarity. And this movie, The Haunting of Julia, which is also incidentally John Lennon's mother's name, seems to wed the two. And so it's let's see, Double Fantasy, which was John Lennon's last album, Milk and Honey, which was his first post-mortem album, and the Instant Karma EP matches into The Haunting of Julia in this very precise way. And so, but like looking at that, it's like, this feels like it's for Sean. Like I'm watching, like the album itself, Double Fantasy, feels like an album for Sean. There's, you know, specific things that are being said to him. It's almost like it gives you the sense that they like knew, you know, it gives me the sense that it's like, and there's something that should feel eerie about that, but actually doesn't for me, you know, it's just like, maybe, who knows, maybe it was like a Golden Bough type thing. And, you know, that would, there's high weirdness with John Lennon and his family stuff. I don't, you know, about like everything of his father is April 1st. Like every time he had any exchange with his father, it always happens to be repeatedly on April 1st. And it's like, is this just a fucking joke? Like, what is this? Like, and that's the way it's all documented. And it's like, you go through every time you have, it's like, what is that about? And I'm like, and so, you know, I don't know if I talked about the phenomenon of the scapegoat much on Grammarica, but it's one of my big,
a little bit
interest, yeah, in the Golden Bough thing. And like, you know, I probably was speaking to it in relationship to Trump. It's like the gangster boss, as Crowley put it when he spoke to the Golden Bough, like what our equivalent would be in our times of like political corruption for what, you know, speaking to what it was then and all the symbolisms, like the fool comes, he performs a ceremonial act where he pulls a branch from an oak tree, which is symbolic of both the king's phallus and the king's daughter. So he's basically like challenging the king's masculinity by pulling this branch. And if he kills the king, he marries the king's daughter, and there's all these requirements. So he basically has to be like an escaped criminal from like a complete other land. It's actually what ALF is about, as far as I can tell. This is ridiculous, but true. So like
the TV show?
The TV show ALF. So basically like,
yeah.
ALF is like A-L-F, right? So if you were to spell, uh-huh, if you were to spell out Aleph, the first Hebrew letter, which corresponds to the fool in tarot, totals 111, Aleph spelled out Aleph Lamed Pei. But like Pei is P, but it's an F sound, you know, in this case, if that's how you spell Aleph. So like whenever you see Alf, you're kind of looking at, you know, the fool. But the thing is that who is he? Like, he's an alien. And like, what is the story with the fool? It's like, he has to be a complete outsider. So it's like, now that the world has all been charted over, where is he going to come from? You know, but it's the ultimate irony that he's come, like he should be turning over everything on his head, like what the fool is supposed to do. Like, I guess is where we get Jubilee, like the releasing the servants and forgiving the debt type thing, you know. But nothing happens because they have to fucking hide him in the garage and from the government, because the government will tear him to pieces, you know. So it's just like, he came, but because this is a thing in anthropology, is that the king would submit himself. You know, so it's like, yeah, he's going in open competition, but sometimes like this is where you get like the suicide king, you know, like he'd kill himself in front of everybody, like, or they put him in the Wicker Man or whatever, you know. It's like, you gotta, you know, it's this whole acknowledgement of royalty being like, every so often we gotta sacrifice ourselves and, you know, keep bringing new blood is the idea. And, you know, they didn't want to have continual inbreeding, and everything actually centers around the princess ultimately too. Mm-hmm. Because whoever marries the princess, you know, the king's daughter is, you know, of what do they say, she's dressed in wrought gold. It's the idea that she is that limb, you know, like that he by him, it's, you know, it's kind of relates to chivalry or whatever, you know. But it's a significant thing. So when I look at Bohemian Grove, what was recorded at Bohemian Grove, I see a reenactment of the Golden Bough ritual, but in reverse, where instead of the leader being sacrificed, they're sacrificing the fool who would challenge the king in the kingdom and then celebrating it. So it appears to me to be an extremely arrogant representation of what happened in Nemi, Diana's mirror, the lake. And so this is like, you know, very significant archetypal thread that you'll see Kubrick make reference to as well. There's the Vanity Fair article where Michael Herr speaks to, he's a producer of, I think, Full Metal Jacket, different Kubrick films, where he was a good friend of Kubrick's. And he says that Kubrick sent the head of Warner Brothers in the 1970s an unabridged set of The Golden Bough and bugged him every couple of weeks about reading it. And eventually wow. the Warner Brothers executive said to Kubrick, he said, look, after a year, he said, I don't have time for mythology. And Kubrick said, this isn't mythology, this is your life. And so implying that Kubrick took it very seriously, you know, and you'll find Jim Morrison made reference to it with his song, Not to Touch the Earth, Not to See the Sun. Those are two chapters side by side towards the end of The Golden Bough. And so when you're speaking to Dead President's Corpse in the driver's car, the engine runs on glue and tar, come along, and not going very far to the east to meet the Tsar. Not going very far because he's saying this old thing is still happening. And so, but wow. it gets twisted because it's not what it used to be with all the awareness and intention that went into it. It's really just a way to align ourselves with nature. We looked at nature, we saw how nature worked, and we intuitively adapted to that. And so now that we've gone on and on thinking that we can, you know, get around certain sacrifices, we get the bitter judgment, so to speak. They could be sweeter, but we're not oriented that way, unfortunately. You know.
Well, wow. I mean, what is your take just in general, especially after doing all of this synchronizing work between film and music, of the film and music industry? What do you think the machinations are behind the scenes?
I think it's nuanced and complex and kind of convoluted also, because you have an industry and then you have artists. And of those artists, I think some of them are very determined to, you know, to offer something to the table. I think they're met with a lot of opposition generally. And it's really easy for people to lose their soul in that machine. And the people who are able to maintain integrity, and it's also, whenever you have people kissing your ass all the time, it's hard to stay with what, you know,
for sure,
your higher intentions, you know. And not just that, but just a paradigm thing. You know, it's like you were in one paradigm and then you end up drifting into another with the fame and whatever you do with that, you know. So it takes different types of individuals to maintain integrity in the midst of all that. You know, I think a lot of things go on, but it's I think the public really likes to have scapegoats. And, you know, I think that a lot of the things that we point to in politics and in the film and music industry, like those are rampant all over the place anyway. Like we want to point our finger and say, look what you guys are doing. But then like, it's kind of like a mirror of what goes on with people, you know? And I'm not into any excuses. I think that there are explanations though. You know, I mean, what do you do when you're super rich? You know, people are like, oh, what do you want to do with that? And it's like, some people just don't know what to do with that, you know? And a lot of identity stuff happens too, when you have people kind of projecting something onto you all the time, and how much you want to like attach yourself to that conception and kind of continually like play the role, you know, which can be, you can have somebody who's wildly entertaining, but at the same time be ultimately miserable. And would you even necessarily be able to pick up and know, recognize that, you know, because I think that there's something about people being authentic. So I think some of the best artists maintain their authenticity in the face of all the pressures and all the influences that would, you know, it's like, what is that story of the pearl of great price? I think there's a couple versions of that, but where there's the prince who goes to Egypt to retrieve this pearl that's being protected by this snake or something. It's an allegory. And then he just gets caught up in all the lifestyle, the luxuriousness of the Egyptian royalty, and he forgets why he was there. It's like, why was I here again? What was I doing? I think we're kind of like that, you know, like we go into something with a specific, we're going to retrieve this, but then it's really easy to get caught up in the sheath that surrounds whatever's at the center, you know, and lose our way, you know.
And that seems like an excellent place to cap off the first hour. In the second hour and a half, we talk about the dark side of Hollywood, the Manson murders, correlation and causation, Zohar, the connection between 9/11 and the COVID narrative, the engineering of consent, the bifurcation of the populace, and much, much more. To hear the rest of the chat, head over to patreon.com/themeltpodcast and become a subscriber for as little as $3 a month. Thanks so much for listening. Take care, people. If you've liked what you've heard and would like to contribute to The Melt, there are a few ways that you can do that. The most tangible would be financially. Just click the Patreon link in the episode notes, and there you will find ways that you can contribute for as little as $3 a month. This will give you access to bonus episodes, early access to regular episodes, and you can also participate in monthly Zoom meetups. Contributing financially will also help make The Melt better, pay the bills, and help to make this podcast a full-time endeavor that I can fully devote my time to and provide you with more content. Another way of contributing would be to go to wherever it is that you subscribe to The Melt and give it a favorable review or rating, and this will help it to reach more people. You can also spread the word to friends and family via social media, email, or word of mouth. And lastly, if none of those options are readily available or appealing to you, simply send your positive thoughts and intentions. In an interconnected and quantumly entangled multiverse, these also go a long way. Thank you.